I'm Lauren McGrath and Ava and Ian, and we're all from the Mental Health and Psychology Based Research Group, so we're all from psychology, and we've kind of come through people up into space, whereas I think often in geography you come the other way around, from space down to people. And so in our work we come across a lot of human geography, a lot of personal geography, so we're really excited to be here today. It's kind of this interdisciplinary kind of space. And the three of us as well, we're all from the University of East London, and we're from the Psychology and Social Change Research Group. The project that we're talking about today is, we've been doing a project for a couple of years looking at a forensic psychiatric ward. It's a big ward space in London. And forensic psychiatric wards are this sort of funny space really, because they're in both the psychiatric and the prison system, and also in neither of them really. They kind of exist in between. So the people who are in these spaces are in prison, they are within the criminal justice system, but they're also not on fixed sentences, they are in treatment for kind of psychiatric problems. And forensic wards and generally other psychiatric spaces over the past 15 years have had a lot of money and redesign put into them. So kind of slightly facetiously called this IKEA, because this is kind of what a lot of psychiatric and forensic psychiatric spaces look like now. So they're very designed to have these kind of clean, modernist spaces, realised aesthetically, quite like this room in fact. If you look at the design of these kind of wards. A lot of them have outside gardens, healing gardens. They're often called, which are meant to be kind of restful places, and people have private bedrooms, often ensuite private spaces. So they're not kind of either asylum spaces, a kind of Victorian asylum, and they're also not particularly like prison spaces either. But despite all of this investment that's gone into psychiatric spaces, a lot of this has gone into the aesthetic nature of the spaces and less into the kind of livability and the lived experience of the spaces. So patients who live in these places still complain of boredom, of little activity, of little interaction, either between service users and patients in the spaces, but also between staff and patients as well. So often, a very common complaint is that staff sit in the ward office behind a pane of glass. Everyone else sits in the ward area, and there's very little interaction unless something goes wrong, unless somebody kicks off in some way. And these spaces tend to be very dominated by the idea of risk management. So these are seen as risky spaces, the people within them are seen as inherently risky. The kind of emptiness of a lot of the space is due to the fact they're emptied out of any stuff that could be used as a weapon or could be used as a ligatious place, so somewhere where someone could hurt themselves. Okay. I'm
going
to pass over to Ian
for... Okay, so... One of the things we're interested in when we look at these kind of spaces actually is to imagine what they're like from a kind of psychological perspective. Yeah? So what are people's kind of psychological experiences of living in these spaces? And conceptually, then, what we've drawn upon then is this idea from an early social psychologist called Kurt Lewin, to use a bit of kind of Americanization pronunciation of his word, of his name, sorry, who came up with this idea of the life space. Okay, so Lewin was a social psychologist, a kind of Gestalt theorist, Germany, kind of fled over when the Nazis came along. And then he had this idea of space, the life space, as being kind of relational, kind of not metric. Okay? So what that means is when you're kind of analysing someone's experiences, you're not seeing that their experiences dependent just on their immediate environment. You're also thinking about what other spaces are connected psychologically for this individual outside. That could be, you know, a home space, a workspace. It could be a past space. So notions of memory are really important in life spaces. Yeah? It could be a future space. Yeah? You might want to imagine, you know, how you're feeling now. You might be, might have had a brilliant morning. Might have got a cheque for £1,000 in the post this morning. So you're in a really kind of happy mood. Yeah? You might also have had an argument with your child. You didn't want to go to school, and that's made you really fed up. Yes, this idea of we kind of carry these kind of emotions with us in our life spaces. So Lewin captures this in this kind of nice quote where he says, the life space of an individual far from being limited to what he considers the present situation, the here and now, right, includes the future, the present, and also the past. Actions, emotions, and certainly the morale of an individual at any instant depends on their total time perspective. So this kind of conceptualization is what we use to think about patients' experiences in the forensic unit. Okay? And what's central to this notion of life space is it's a dynamic kind of concept. Yeah? It's about movement. Okay? So it's not about kind of space that's been static, defined by static kind of metrical properties. It's about how what possibilities for movement are there in these spaces. And then what becomes interesting is obviously what possibilities for movement in a physical and a psychological sense are there in spaces of containment. Yeah, when you're bodily kind of restricted from movement.
So just quickly, as I've already touched on this, but the forensic setting that we're talking about here, the specific project that we were looking at is a redesigned forensic inpatient facility, a medium secure unit. So this is somewhere where the people have moved from an old space into this new design, very shiny, specialist kind of space, and we were looking really at how this redesigned space has shaped the experiences of the ward and whether or not it's really changed the practices that happen there at all. So this is a large facility. It's meant to have a kind of fluid recovery path, so people start off in one ward, move to the next, and then out into the community. Obviously in reality that's a bit less fluid. There's one ward for female patients, which is relatively unusual in forensic psychiatric care because there aren't that many women in the system. And there's also a specialist personality disorder ward. And for our methodology for this project, we had 40 participants. We interviewed 20 service users and 20 staff. For the service users, we used a photo reproduction method, so we got people to go around the ward and take photos of the places that were important to them, and then in the interview we asked them to kind of provide a photo narrative and to tell us why they were important to us. And the staff, we had semi-structured interviews. And these were our research questions. So we're thinking about what's the space like to live in, how has the new space shifted these practices, how does the ward relate to experiences before and after being on the ward, and how do these spaces interact with the experiences of distress?
So today specifically we're talking about people's experiences, sort of sensual experiences, and how whether there's possibilities for movement when you're actually on the ward. As we discussed before, the ward environments are quite sterile, they're stripped down of sort of activity, even though they're supposed to be therapeutic, you're supposed to get better. There's very little sort of interrelationships, and it's supposed to be more homely when they've been redesigned, but that's perhaps not how they're experienced. So specifically today we're going to talk about sensation. So what are the sounds that people hear when they're living on the ward? How do they feel when they're living on the ward? And also movement. How do you move within the space? And what are your possibilities for movement when you leave hospital? How do you think about your life outside after you've been discharged? So as an example of what the life space is like, in the corner there's a meal and a chair, and it's positioned in that particular way because that's how people enjoy or have their meal. It's a kind of functional instrumental process where you're just going to get fed and then you leave the room quickly. As Laura was saying before, oftentimes meal times can be quite fraught because the whole idea is around protecting people, protecting the cutlery, stopping any kind of confrontations that may happen in the dining hall. If I can just read one of the quotes. So one of the quotes focuses on the environment being filthy and dirty and nothing to do. The other one talks about meal times in particular, where everyone is just eating, not interacting, as you would expect. And also what happens when people are eating. What is the role of the staff? And oftentimes, rather than sitting and eating with patients, they sort of stand and watch. So patients are constantly under some level of surveillance. And the last one in particular that is quite horrible, that the food is not quite well prepared, and how everything that you would associate with getting nourished is getting sort of stripped away when you're in that particular environment. Okay. Another thing is what patients do within that particular environment. So this first quote talks about this man who sits in an armchair where he has the opportunity to watch what's going on the ward. So you can watch what's happening, you can watch the staff, you can watch the activity, and in a sense, it keeps him safe. It makes him feel as if he's resisting this sort of sense of surveillance. Also, the next quote speaks to how patients feel when they're in their bedroom spaces. This particular one talks about being looked at without being aware of who's seen through the door. So patients, they need to be seen to make sure that they're not that they're safe, that they're still breathing. And quickly, how can we think about this? We can think about this in relation to sounds, the sounds that people are hearing. So keys clinking, doors slamming, muffled conversation, telephones ringing, very unfamiliar as far as your homely sounds would be associated. Patients spend a lot of time either in their bedrooms or in communal spaces. What are they doing in those spaces? As we said, those spaces are emptied out, but what they're actually doing is kind of making and over-focusing on what's going on, so feeling a sense of fear, focusing inwards, listening out for things that might be a threat, and we conceptualize that as kind of getting caught up, getting entangled in the everyday activity of the ward. And in some ways, becoming kind of super attuned to the minutiae of what's going on the wall, because there's nothing else within those spaces. And that we sort of theorize that that mimics sort of past previous distress, the loss of control, the possible experiences of abuse.
Okay, this is what happens when you have three people doing it. There's an institutional logic in here of movement, yeah? So every patient's going to have a care pathway. The whole idea is that you've got to move, okay? The whole thing is going to set up movement. But so what we're interested in is how to kind of the service users experience that kind of institutional movement. Does their psychological sense of movement kind of map onto that? And then on this extract here, then, there was someone talking about this, okay? So they were asked about this system of movement through the different wards on this unit. So it goes, it's not too bad. The thing about it is sometimes you're sort of starting, when you move them, you're sort of starting a little bit from the beginning. Because the team are sort of the primary nurses change and no one seems to know you. Okay, I'm not going to read through all of that, but what he's describing here is this idea that when you make progress, you move to another ward, and this ward might be a ward with lower secure wards that might facilitate greater things like escorted leave or unescorted leave away from the unit. And of course, this institutionally is supposed to be movement and progression, but isn't always experienced that way, okay? Because in a kind of notion of kind of a life space where one's experience is sort of dependent on the relations that we have, those relations also obviously include the staff and the wards, the people you get to know. And when you move ward, then you kind of lose some of them. So though in one sense you're supposed to, institutionally it's kind of setting up for progression and a sense of progression, it actually has the kind of opposite effect when you feel like you're kind of starting again. One of the other things I'm going to really rush through now is the kind of relationship with the outside. Yeah? So again, this whole institutional logic of movement in that you're going to move outside. But these are people without a fixed center, so they do not know when that's going to happen. Okay? But from the notion of kind of life space, which draws on kind of concept of topology, is that you don't have, when you're not thinking about kind of metric space, then actually the space of the ward is connected to the outside, and then it becomes quite interesting how patients get a sense of the outside. And this is an extract where someone talks about how they've organised their room with a mirror on the wall, and they can see through this mirror the kind of outside, and they position themselves on the bed in such a way that they can kind of see half outside and they're kind of half inside, and it gives them a sense of kind of being able to control their kind of psychological engagement with the outside space. And if you like, in a kind of topological sense, this mirror becomes like a kind of surface, and in topologies, the surface is a space, just an in-between thing. Yeah? That sort of allowing for kind of inside and outside kind of simultaneously. That's a really nice thing to extract from that. Oops. Okay. Yeah.
I skipped the conclusions. So just the key points. So these forensic psychiatrists basically experience an entity of life interaction or movement. They're kind of, but with because they are in ambiguous spaces, they're kind of in between prison and psychiatric care, but also they don't have an end point as well. So quite a lot of people we interviewed expressed a preference for prison. They'd all come from prison because they said at least then you know when you're going home, whereas in these spaces you don't have an end point. Within the ward, people create this richness of sensation and movement, even though there is no richness of sensation and movement that's within the spaces themselves. So they kind of either attune really deeply into very minute details or create this sense of movement or sense of movement within these very static places. And just very quickly, we thought some implications with all of the logic of these places is that they are preparing people for life in the community, but there's very little within the ward space that actually does that in any meaningful way. And so one of the things that might need to happen is if people are very much attuned to these very quiet, static kind of places, to go outside into the outside world, and people talked about this, is going to be a very sensory overload and kind of need retuning almost back into the outside world. And also building on this kind of sense of connection to the outside that people are already kind of creating within the space in order to promote a kind of an easier path out back into the community.
Thank you.